and just a vision birthed into the spot. I accept my praise, my blame, my joy, my sorrow. I realize we are in truth, the truth we seek. God, perfect this very moment.
Good morning.
This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly, well, usually weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us, Richard Bowes. I think I'm on. This is apparently something that I've heard any number of BAI people complain about. By the way, on the air. But hi, Sally. Hi, Catherine. But it's the good night people, you know. Not the good night people, but... The good night people, yes, night but the people who work here at night, who are good.
And no pun on, like, he who was in this time slot, Robert Knight, you know, it was a good night. Yeah, he was excellent.
He was wonderful.
But, anyway, what was I going to mention before we started the show proper? Oh, yes, I was, can you hear yourself, Catherine, through these headphones? I don't really hear me much.
You have to turn it on.
Yeah. On this device, yes.
Okay.
Actually, over here.
No. Let me know when you.
Can you hear yourself?
Okay. One, two, and through. The Vorpal Sword. No. Yeah. I thought it was turned all the way up. No. I mean, only barely. More ambient noise than anything else. I hear Rick, talk into your microphone.
I am speaking into my microphone.
Yeah, okay, I've got the wrong mic potted up. Try that again.
I am speaking.
Ah, now I can hear you. At least I can hear him.
Not you?
No, I never can. I've heard other people complain on the air about that.
Yeah, this mic is much softer.
Yeah.
Take your pot up.
Yes, I will.
Romantic world of radio.
Better.
Are we live?
Better. Yes. Yes, we're live. Of course we're live. Yes.
Jeez.
Watch it.
I said cheese.
Oh, you want cheese?
No. My goodness.
When have I... Yeah, I mean, this is nothing. When Max is around, it gets really bad with me just... mouthing off about nothing in particular. At any rate, let me also move this monitor so I can see my guest. Hi, Rick.
Hello, how are you?
I'm well.
Nice to see you here.
Thank you. So, announcements. Yes, 388 Atlantic Avenue. It's not only where we are now, but it's where the next... reading will be for the New York Review of Science Fiction readings, and that will be on October 6th. And our readers will be Matthew Kressel, who is, if you were listening to Ellen Datlow last week, it was a real good show, by the way. He co-hosts the KGB Fantastic Fiction reading series with her and his first novel. World of Shards. I'm sorry. I should have printed this out and brought it with me. And of course, the computer that I have in front of me isn't on the internet. So you know that this is typical. I could take my phone out and probably get it from that, and probably have Matt texting me right now. But it's World of Shards. Matt Kressel is a fine short story writer, and his first novel is due, and he will be reading from that. And with him will be, well, we call her Brooke because that's her byline, but she calls herself Beau Bolander, who, as far as I know, has only written short stories, but my...
That is correct.
Yeah. Have you read any of them, Rick?
Yes, I have. They're quite good.
Yeah, they really are. She has quite a voice. I encountered her through my audio editorship for Lightspeed Magazine, where she's had a couple of stories, and one of them that I edited was like an insane Raymond Chandler-esque kind of thing that had a phrase in it like, there were more butts visible in that ashtray than one would find in a strip bar. And just phrases like that. She's a wonderful writer, and this will be her reading debut in New York because she only moved here. From the Dallas-Fort Worth area a couple of months ago. So it will be quite an evening, and admission is free. We bother you for donations, but we give away stuff as well. And it's here at 388 Atlantic Avenue, begins at 7 p.m. And for more information on Facebook, you can go to the NYRSF, N-Y-R-S-F, New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, a group, or go to ourwolf.com and go through the obsolete-looking website until you see about the readings. And all the information, more information than you can possibly want, will be there. Good morning, Rick.
Well, good morning to you.
Thank you. Yes, it's been a long day. I've been heavily immersed in you talking about editing. I am heavily, heavily immersed on two novels and a collection of short stories, all of the, plus the podcasts.
Whose collection?
Women Destroy Science Fiction.
Oh, so it's an anthology, right?
It's an anthology, yeah, I shouldn't have said yes. Collection. It's an anthology.
It's become, I mean, Women Destroying, this story that I'm going to read is Queers Destroying Fantasy. You know, it's much harder work being a queer now. I mean, destroying things. And
yeah, well, I actually had a total problem with the concept, I hope John Joseph Adams isn't listening, to Queers Destroy Science Fiction, which I was the audio editor of the podcast of, because A, and this is a conversation you and I and Sam J. Miller and I and Delaney people. Sort of agreed with me to an extent, is that I've always had a problem with the Q word, because in my day, and no doubt in yours, it was nothing but a derogatory, nasty, nasty phrase synonymous with
bigotry.
Other, but more than bigotry, it begged for violence in the Queens neighborhood where I grew up, where there was a known
well, that is not an uncommon
crossroads.
That is not an uncommon thing that the oppressed take the derogatory term onto themselves. I mean, this happens in other circumstances.
And it does, and then sometimes it goes away again.
Right.
It happened for a because of my generation, I have a problem with that word because I'm afraid that it will reverse again at some point. Number two, the whole destroy concept is no, it's create. There was some jackass blogger, apparently, who stated, it was probably Vox Day, I don't know, who said something like, you know, women are destroying science fiction, so that's how the whole destroy thing happened. And so that came there. And number three was in Queers Destroy Science Fiction, most of the stories were fantasy.
Yes, that was strange. And now I'm this story that I'm going to read is in Queers Destroy Fantasy.
Yes.
But yes, I arrived there and discovered it had already been destroyed by all those other queers that had
or whether we're already destroying fantasy. So right. I had problems with, I had no problems with any of the stories. Many
the stories
of them
are fine, and I don't think anyone will pay attention to the labels.
Yeah, I know. But anyhow, the Women Destroy Science Fiction was a special issue of Lightspeed Magazine, and we did
an anthology,
podcasts. But now that we're adding approximately another 25 stories, the rest of the stories from that entire endeavor, and that will be, that's not a podcast, that's an audio book.
Well, that sounds terrific.
So I'm working, it will be. And I have till October 7th to finish it. So
it'll keep you busy and off the streets.
Oh, it's doing that.
That's right. So society is
benefiting. This is the first time I've been out of the house since last week's show.
Well,
that's true. That's actually true. Fresh Direct. Well, you know, it's places that deliver to you. It's a terrible thing. You never have. You ended up like with folded hands, which is a reference to a Jack Williamson story.
Yeah. Well,
So speaking of which, you have not one, but two stories in the upcoming queer series. One is Queers Destroy Fantasy, and the other is horror, I believe.
I don't think, no.
October is horror.
Well, I'm not, the only story that I have contributed to this is the one that I'm going to read, and that's for Queers Destroy Fantasy.
Aren't we somehow reprinting There's a Hole in the City?
They have bought reprint rights to There's a Hole in the City. I don't know when it's coming out.
Oh, I do, but I shouldn't say anything more.
Right, okay. I don't mind.
I just know it's in the line for, there's a different editor for reprints.
Yes, I know.
Than there is for originals.
He's keeping more editors employed than almost anybody at this point.
Scott, only two on the literary side and outside of special issues.
It seemed to me that there were quite a few, but I'm not going to talk about that.
And then there's the podcast producer and the audio editor. I am the audio editor.
Right. Yes, it's a grand enterprise, and
we won two Hugos.
And you won two Hugos.
Well, yes. That is to say, we won the same Hugo 2 years in a row.
Right.
But we got two rockets for it, and we weren't puppy approved, which is even better. So they haven't taken notice of us, although between Women Destroy Science Fiction and Queers Destroy Science Fiction, no doubt we'll be in their sights.
I don't know. I think probably that extremely boring thing is more or less over.
I think so, too. Yeah, I think it's peaked and it's done its thing.
But I also think that it is of almost no interest to anyone who isn't, you know, directly in the genre. I mean, it's pretty small potatoes.
It actually is to me, for reasons involving, believe it or not, Pacifica Radio.
Well, Pacifica Radio, yes. In what way is Pacifica Radio like the Hush Puppies?
Well, it's like the Hugos.
Oh, well, it's like the Hugos.
It's yes. Like the Hugos that both
are... Well, Pacifica are, and the Hugos are very similar, yes.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Because their leadership, their results are determined more or less by a democracy.
Yes.
You pay and you vote. And in that way, they are very similar. So the kind of thing that happens that can game one can happen to the other.
Well, the Hugos are the only major award in speculative fiction that doesn't have some kind of a gate. I mean, to get into the Nebulas, you have to be a member of CIFWA. To get into the Locus Award, you have to be vetted by various editors and so on whose recommendations form the long lists.
How many people vote on that?
Thousands vote on it, but
oh, really?
There is,
okay.
There is first a process by which...
For the short list.
There is a process for creating a long list, and the long list is then turned into a short list by the process of voting.
Okay.
But that's the way they do it. And then a lot of the other awards, World Fantasy and... Shirley Jackson are done by... Judges, something.
Yeah.
But the Hugo was very open that way. Now, they're going to have to do something to control this, but, you know, they'll do this or they won't do this.
Yeah, and that'll take 2 years. I don't know what went on this year at the business meeting, but whatever they decided, it takes 2 years for it to reach fruition. But, yeah, I think you're right. I think that the fury is over and will end up signifying nothing.
Yes.
But it made for a lot of interesting articles by a lot of interesting people. So, you know, it was a sport.
kept people busy and off the streets.
Well, yes, exactly. Outside of the Lightspeed stories, what have you had recently?
I've had quite a few stories came out this year. I had a story in Uncanny, and I had a story in... Oh, my goodness, I can't remember the name of it. Oh, this is so embarrassing. But this happens when you get old. I had a couple of original anthologies stories, the Doll Collection. I had a... And in the Doll Collection anthology...
Edited by Ellen Datlow.
Yes, of course, we have to say that. I had photographs of dolls from what was once a very extensive doll collection. I was in the business of buying and selling dolls. And I wrote a story called The Doll Court. And it's about people who have mistreated dolls and are dragged in their dreams to stand trial.
Oh, my God.
Which kind of was me. But
I have to read that one.
Do read that one. It was great to write. But... I also had a story very recently in fantasy and science fiction called Rascal Saturday.
Right.
I am at this point, you know, there are those interviews that they do in which, you know, they write a bunch of questions, and I'm talking about Rascal Saturday and that, and FNSF will put up the interview at some point online. And let's see, what else is coming? Well, The Duchess and the Ghost, which is the story I have here, will be out in December.
And that will be a Lightspeed story, as a matter of fact.
It will be a Lightspeed story.
I don't know yet whether it's going to be a podcast story.
Well, it will or it won't. And
that's...
But the thing with them is that they have also bought rights, as I said before, the reprint rights to There's a Hole in the City, which is my... 9/11 story, which has now, I believe, been reprinted, republished, redone 16 times.
And broadcast here.
Broadcast here on WBAI.
Almost annually.
Almost annually, yes.
Very, very proud of the fact that we got it on the 10th anniversary in prime time.
Yes, and that the... station was actually working at that moment.
That was an amazing thing. It was an 11 a.m. broadcast. We walked in at about 10:40, and Catherine, as a matter of fact,
was
there along with the then program director du jour and the station manager, all trying to figure out how to bring it up. And about 3 minutes before the scheduled time, and we had a heck of a time getting there, because, of course, we were, you know, about six blocks from ground zero. And we had a heck of a time getting there. I'll refill that for you in a moment.
Oh, speaking about a glass of water.
Yes, yes. glad you made that clear. And the radio station, miraculously knowing that we were going to be doing this, came on the air right... in time for the broadcast.
I expected that. I am used to miracles. But anyway, yes, I got a review in The New Yorker. It was for an anthology that included There's a Hole in the City, and it received very, very complimentary criticism.
Who wrote that again? I've forgotten. I posted it, I think, even before you. I posted it on your Facebook page.
Douglas Lane edited the magazine, and I've forgotten the name, the anthology, and I've forgotten the name of the young
man. The New Yorker writer, yeah.
Of the New Yorker writer, who I've now seen pictures of him. He looks like he's 12 years old, but hey, you know. I'm quite...
I was very impressed by...
I was impressed by the fact that my name was mentioned in those circumstances. I never thought that would happen during my lifetime. But The New Yorker has become rather more friendly to speculative fiction. Maybe it's this young man who's doing it. I don't know.
There are actually a couple of writers there. And unfortunately, some of it has been showing up more in their blogs than the magazine itself. But even the magazine has been...
Yes, the world is definitely going completely to hell.
Yeah.
Yes. Harold Ross would be so upset if he would have come back to Earth. Yes. Well, yes, I suppose. Drunk and disorderly, he'd come staggering back into the world. Yes. Yeah, so I'm quite happy with events at Lightspeed.
And books, we haven't mentioned your books.
Well, I have no books coming out. There will
be
books.
But you have several in print.
I do. I have 10 books. I've written 10 books at this point. And the most recent, the novel Dust Devil on a Quiet Street, which was on the short list for the Lambda and for the World Fantasy Awards. And then there were two collections, The Queen, The Cambion, and Seven Others, which is, I think, my favorite of all my books. It's a little tiny book of modern fairy tales.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
It's illustrated, and it's
published by Aqueduct
Press, and that was really very nice. And then there's another collection, the name of which I've now managed to forget. If Angels Fight, which is named after a story of mine, which won the World Fantasy Award, and you would think I would remember it, but you would be wrong.
That's because you've actually had quite a nice run of publications coming out and coming up a major reprint.
Yes, From the Files of the Time Rangers is going to come out from Letha Press at some point next year.
And that'll be its first mass market
edition. That will be the first paperback edition, and if we can, and be the first ebook edition of it. It came out from Golden Griffin, and it was only in hardcover. It was on the Nebula shortlist, actually. It was nominated for a Nebula Award. And I don't know. I'm trying to see what we can do for this, what kind of new cover we can get for it. Certainly the cover that the book originally had is very nice. I don't know if we can afford to get that again. But having the books come back to life is very exciting. My Minions of the Moon, which came out in 1999, was in... You see, the thing
those
that happened
are the Kevin
in 2000
Grierson stories.
Those are the Kevin Grierson stories. The thing that happened in 2013 was through sheer carelessness. I had three new books come out: Dust Devil, and The Queen, The Cambion, and Seven Others, and If Angels Fight came out. And in addition, a reprint of Minions of the Moon came out, and it was really exciting. It was very exciting. More excitement than an elderly person should have, in fact. I am, at this point, putting together stories. It's going to be Boston. It's going to be Boston stories.
Yeah,
and
so a couple of which you've already read on the air here.
Have I really? Oh, my.
At least one, yeah.
Oh, that's right. Fordham Court.
Yeah,
yes,
that's right.
Yes, Fordham Court. How quickly one forgets. Yes, which is set in Jamaica Plains, which is where Fordham Court is. And there are a couple of bigger stories that were published over the last couple of years, stories that I tell to friends, which was published in, The Revelator, which is an online magazine.
Matt Chaney?
Matt Chaney and Eric. Oh, dear. Don't ever get old. Whatever other mistakes you make, don't get old. You forget everything. I remember my name, but that's about it. That was set in Boston, and that will be in there. And there is also a story, 7 Days of Poe, which is a semi-autobiographical story.
But how much of your fiction isn't?
A lot of the fiction isn't, actually. Especially at the beginning when I was writing, you know, actual complete novels and not fix-ups. Let's see. Now, that's an interesting question.
It's actually one that I've intended to ask you.
Many times.
Yes.
Well, I had a story. It was on the Nebula shortlist called Sleepwalking Now and Then, which is certainly not autobiographical. and Rascal Saturday is an autobiographical. I'm writing stories about a future New York in which it's called...
I'm sorry. I found a way to get online, and I typed in Revelator Cheney, and I got all these YouTube things of Dick Cheney.
Well, you know, he is a relative.
Is he really?
No, I'm joking.
No, Eric Schaller.
Eric Schaller. I'm sorry, Eric, that I forgot your name. On the other hand, I still remember mine.
If people go to the RevelatorMagazine.com right now, you'll see special bookworm issue with short stories by Richard Bowes, D.F. Lewis, and Mickey Kendall.
Yes, and it's an excellent issue. It's an excellent magazine, although the editors are disturbed people. But nonetheless, it
as
is...
As are some of the writers.
All of the writers.
And stories I tell to friends. Now, you read part of that on this show as well.
Yes, I did, and I don't know, did I read parts of 7 Days of Poe? The part of 7 Days of Poe, it's a kid, me, actually, working in the Boston Public Library and coming out sexually. The part that everyone liked in that, I will give you this little hint, and John Armstrong did a podcast about it. It was the collector, who was a gentleman who really did exist.
Oh, God.
More or less.
Yeah.
Did I read that?
No. I just heard you and Sidney Smith discussing the collector in great detail off the air.
Really? When did that happen?
I'd say about 4 years ago at 120 Wall Street. And I had already started the show. In fact, I think I was still on at 5 a.m. at that point. And you and Sidney were, you know, happily chatting away in the news department while I was saying, and Rick will be in here anytime now.
Well, the collector was a gentleman.
But outside of that, you were talking about the collector when
the
I
collector,
left the room.
Yes. Well, he'll be in there. He'll be in the novel about being a gay kid in Boston. And, yes, he was a gentleman. If you were hard up for a little money, you could go and sell your undershorts to the collector. And it was $3 for a...
If you were male.
Oh, if you admit, yes, of
yes,
course.
Well, yes.
You know, yes.
Well, yeah, it needs to be mentioned.
But he had like 20,000 jockey shorts in there or something. But anyway, yes. So all of that is in the future, and people can look forward to this, and it will be serious, it will be tragic, it will be disgusting.
Will it be speculative?
Yes.
Okay, because many of these stories are absolutely true.
Well, I do...
And speaking of absolutely true, I have to do a station break. This is WBAI, New York. Sorry, go on.
And that's absolutely true. Yes. I have always managed to put something of the fantastic into the stories, and especially the ones in my family, because the family itself is fairly surrealistic. So, yes, it will be speculative fiction, and it will be, in many ways, autobiographical,
mm-hmm.
As the last... From the Files of the Time Rangers is time travel, and it isn't in any way autobiographical, but both Minions of the Moon and Dust Devil on a Quiet Street are.
Yeah, and from the Files of the Time Ranger, I thought it was quite a tour de force is how I would describe it. It's really, I love the way it all comes together.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I reread it, and I hadn't reread it since it came out in 2005.
With the introduction by Cage Baker.
Really beautiful introduction by Cage Baker, which the book actually was not worthy of the introduction, but it was a very nice introduction. And you know, this is one of the benefits of getting old. I forget parts of the book, and I'm reading my own book, and they're thinking, oh my goodness gracious, how did I ever do that? You know, I really am looking forward to having this come out, because the access to it originally was very slight. Golden Griffin did not have any kind of distribution system or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But we will see. We will see what happens. So those are two things in the future. the gay boy in Boston, and and the reissue of From the Files of the Time Rangers. And I don't know, you know, I have all of these stories set in the big arena and involving, you know, the rising tide water and New York becoming, you know, the Venice of the West and that sort of thing. I don't know. There may be a novel in that, or a book in that of some kind.
Yeah, there may be. Yeah, we'll talk about it off the air. I was going to say that would go with some of the photos I showed you earlier.
That it certainly. Well, that the water is still pretty much out in the water. I'm talking about a New York in which the water has come to visit in a,
yes,
in
exactly,
an intimate way.
So it's already 2:05.
Oh my God.
So, and you're going to read a full-length story.
I'm going to read
us.
A full-length story, whether you like it or not.
Yeah. So, any intro desired for this?
You mean anything?
Setup?
No, I can tell you a little bit about the story.
I think if people hear it, though,
they will remember it themselves. Yeah. They will know it themselves.
And what I will do as you begin is I will go and refresh your cup of water.
This is a euphemism, actually. No, it is. It's actually.
And I'll also see if I can deaden the sound from the studio next door.
Okay.
And you may
commence when I. The story is The Duchess and the Ghost. When I remember the Duchess, it's in vignettes, snapshots. Even when she lived, that's how I saw her. Now, I hope it's how some people will remember me. My family lost everything in the Revolution, she sighed, the first time we met. The accent was unplaceable. The houses in Paris and Rome, the estate in Maryland, all gone. Her hands fluttered away to illustrate this. Her eyes seemed to focus on another world. What revolution was that, I asked. I mean, she was old, but not A Tale of Two Cities or Lenin and Stalin old. The sexual revolution, she said, and appeared astounded that I wouldn't know this. In fact, I had heard a little about her family disowning her. I had no doubt mine was really unhappy with me, too. Though by then, my only contact with them was in my nightmares. I had turned 18 near the tail end of 1961, about 2.5 years before encountering the Duchess. A few weeks after that birthday, coming home from college, on my freshman year Christmas break, I abandoned the train in the old original Penn Station. My one glance back had showed me a face staring with shock and horror from a train window. That face seemed like what my ghost would look like, and I lost myself fast in the noise and confusion of pre-Christmas New York City. When I met the Duchess, I still gave my age as 18, and only a few had begun to doubt it. Maybe I was a careless and lazy boy, but I was not entirely a stupid one. On our first meeting, I'd guessed that the Duchess's past was as twisted and hidden as a path through the dark forest. It was how I had come to see mine. She was all about contradictions. The cheekbones were elegance itself. The voice was throaty, a loud whisper, if there is such a thing. But the hands were larger than might be expected of a lady of breeding. She got away with an array of giveaways like that, because this was 1964, and a significant part of the population was still blind enough to believe that Liberace was straight. She had lived much of her life in the world I'd found in New York, and read my reaction right off my face. Silly girl. If they can recognize what I am, or what you're up to, it means they are as deeply perverted as either of us. And those are the most dangerous ones. The rest are like sleeping cattle. She wore a maroon Borsellino hat, and what I later learned to recognize as a knockoff of a Schiaparelli tennis outfit. This was daring, because of the way it exposed somewhat muscular legs, and also because Greenwich Village was far from being as free and open sexually as was advertised. The mafia ruled, and the street style was macho. Women did not wear shorts unless they had tough boyfriends. Men got busted for going in drag. Shorts for male were legal, but unwise. Wearing them in this city, if you were above the age of maybe 8, meant you were gay and for sale. I'd found out that early in life in the neighborhood, when both my pairs of long pants were at the laundry and the Italian kids on the corner called me faggot for showing my knees. Boys I knew got the crap beaten out of them by the street gangs for walking funny. The Duchess was brave. When I told her that, she said, "Darling, bravery is a euphemism for stupidity." She and I stood in a small room with a view of the back garden of an Italian restaurant. The Duchess had a 5-room apartment in the gentle curve of Commerce Street in the village. It was rent-controlled, which meant she paid very little for it. There was a big enough bed, a table with a lamp, a chair, and an armoire. The walls were blue that I've never been able to match anywhere. On the table was a silver-framed photo of a European guy with a dueling scar and what I saw as a sappy smile. She said, "For those few years on the Adriatic, the Margrave and I were of the same sex, which was convenient. Then he died, which was convenient in its own way." I was going to ask which sex they'd shared, but I thought better of it, because this was going to be my room for $30 a month. My sugar daddy had just said goodbye to me, and a boy who finds himself in that situation has to take hints and detect undercurrents. I'd studied it carefully from all angles and been shocked by how narrow the choices were for a rent boy who would not be a boy for much longer. Roger Tippett, the designer, had turned out to be my final daddy. My occasional crying out in my sleep did me in. As he slid me out of his life, a dancer from the New York City Ballet School was waiting in the wings. He said it was time I met the Duchess. I knew her when she ruled the city. Since then, she's been through her trust fund, but you can learn a lot about attitude from the Duchess. Then he added, "Never let it be said I don't take care of my old tricks." He smiled the way he did when a private thought pleased him and said, "That's how I always want to be remembered." I paid my first month's rent and moved in. After I'd gotten to know the Duchess to the extent one could do that, I told her about how Tippett wanted to be remembered. When they begin to write their own epitaphs, it means they want us to attribute human motives to them, she said. People like that have an innate ability to rise above everyone else's problems. Beyond doubt, Tippett was the biggest asshole, but he wasn't the worst daddy by any means. That would be Augustus, who made me dress in a blue blazer and tan chinos like a private schoolboy, insisted I call him Uncle Augie in public, and dispensed corporal punishment when stoned. But the one I missed then, and that I still miss over half a century later, is Garcia, my first daddy. He was tending bar at the Cedar Tavern on 8th Street on a quiet December Sunday night when a scared, drunken kid staggered in the door carrying a suitcase. It was my first night in the city where drinking age was 18. All I knew immediately was that Garcia was as old as my father, almost 50. He looked and sounded tough. But even as a traumatized kid, I recognized real gentleness and charm. He brought me home, had me sleep on his couch until I trusted him enough to let him take me to bed. It felt good just being near him. He listened to my tales of untimely erections that led to my getting jumped in school showers and stomach punched in hallways, my parents giving me hard slaps and crew cuts if I wasn't butch enough, and my college freshman roommate lodging a complaint about being placed with a fag. A report about this had been sent to my father and was awaiting my arrival home the night I ran away. Garcia introduced me to the folk and jazz-obsessed village, taught me the ins and outs of the neighborhood. When he was certain I didn't want to go back to my family and was afraid of getting drafted into the army, he brought me to a scary guy called a doorman in a cellar in an alley far east on Bleecker Street. Garcia had said he wanted me to get used to this place. He bought me counterfeit ID and draft cards, supposedly the best in the city. On these, I was Anthony Willis, a name I had to memorize. From then on, my nickname was Tony. After he made them, the doorman, big and bald, sat behind the desk where he did his forgery. At his back was a door opening onto a pitch-black room. He looked at me with these dead eyes and told Garcia, Your boyfriend needs more than an alias. He's got ghosts. In the dark behind him, I saw a face staring with horror from a window as a train rolled out of Penn Station. It was the face I saw when I looked back that first night in the city, the one that made me cry out in my sleep. Garcia saw my fear, put his arms around my shoulders, and blocked my line of sight to the black room. "You bastard," he told the doorman. "You didn't have to show him that. He's just a kid, and when he's ready, he'll make up his own mind about what to do with his ghosts. You won't cheat him out of half his life like you did me." The doorman told him never to come back, but I noticed he didn't tell me. Life with the Duchess, a couple of years later, was much different from Garcia. I remember standing naked in her living room, much to her amusement and that of the Countess, her transvestite disciple. I'd paid the first month's rent, but the Duchess wondered how I'd pay the next. I had savings, but knew how fast they could evaporate. I had few skills beyond being a boy. The Countess was short, dark-haired, and unmistakably out of Brooklyn. She ran a string of male prostitutes. "Girls that strip down and turn out to be guys are what's big right now," she said. "Not sure that's right for you." They were trying to get me into drag, but the high heels were deadly, and I hated the painful business of hiding my junk. The Countess was vexed as I stumbled out of the shoes and the penis gaff dropped on the floor. "What possible use is he?" she asked. "He makes you feel pity. Not a big market anywhere." "He isn't a stupid boy," said the Duchess, trying to put the best light on the situation. The Countess noticed a single white hair on the back of my head, took the mirror, and showed it to me. "Eventually, I'll be distinguished-looking," I suggested. "You'll be foolish-looking," said the Countess, clipping it off savagely. "Worse than foolish, middle-aged," said the Duchess, and we all shuddered. She was reading the Village Voice. "There's a boutique called Hope is a Thing with Leathers. Emily Dickinson, I cry for you. It's over on East 9th Street. There's a string of boutiques over there. Straight ladies are getting divorced. With the alimony, they hire a smart fag and open these very twee shops. Dear God, one is called Hippopotami. Have feelings, too. For larger women, no doubt." She looked at me. "I know who to talk to. Get dressed. You'll be the smart fag," she said. And so it was. The Duchess was a semi-legend in the world of boutique fashion. I found out I liked selling and being the gay boy in a shop full of women. After landing the boutique job, I began spending little time at the Duchess's place. I'd met Frankie, who played piano around the village when he could. The first boyfriend my age, the first sex partner who made less money than I did. "How silly of you. Men are always disgusting, but sometimes they're rich," the Duchess said when I informed her. I was caught between a new feeling of freedom and the old recurring dreams in which I was scared, alone, and locked in an attic in my family's house. That summer was a funeral on my day off from work. An old friend of the Duchess and Countess was being seen off at St. Luke's in the Field Church on Christopher Street. I was introduced to the other mourners as the son of an old family retainer, and the campiness of this made me smile. It was a beautiful day. In the church gardens were butterflies, including a large red and black one. The Duchess said, "In ancient Greece, a butterfly was thought to be the spirit of the departed." The apartment had lots of closets and storage spaces, and she was going through them. I knew from the Countess the Duchess had cancer, and knew she would never tell me directly. Cancer was a secret thing back then. You told no one and hoped it would go away, was how it worked. The Duchess, though, did say things like, "The problem with living in the moment is the crowds living in that moment with you." I tried to be around and help her when I could. She never tried to make me feel guilty. The funeral had made me remember Garcia, and because I thought about it a lot and she did know stuff, I told the Duchess about the strange thing that had happened when Garcia took me to get forged papers. The Duchess's face was a mask as she listened to my tale of the doorman and the ghost. When I said I still dreamed about the face in the train window and mentioned other bad stuff in my dreams, she changed the subject, asked me to help her go through the hall closet. I repeatedly went up a ladder and took down boxes from Paris shops, a small safe, a hussar's uniform, family records, and a midget bridal gown. Occasionally, the Duchess exclaimed about something. "Dear Mama's beagle whip," or "Keys to Uncle Fargo's pleasure room." I understood, or hoped, that she was making all this up. But I was self-centered enough to be disappointed that she paid so little attention to something that pained and scared me. The next morning, I woke up and found, on my table, a Xerox copy of a New York Herald Tribune page from 1923. This hadn't been there when I fell asleep. It was photos and commentary about the Knickerbocker Cotillion, a very elite dancing school with young people in evening clothes. One shot was of a guy, maybe 20. Jason Arkwright, he was called. The Countess had told me that Arkwright was the Duchess's family name and that I was never to mention it. But the guy's remote gaze and cheekbones revealed the family resemblance. He was gorgeous, but somehow looked hurt, like my ghost in my dream did. I knew this wasn't a brother. It was the Duchess in an unhappy manifestation. She wasn't home, but on her kitchen table was another copy of a newspaper page. It was 1932, the Daughters of Gotham charity ball. It features guys in tuxedos and a lineup of women in evening gowns and hair, made to do things hair was never meant to do, looking right out of Hollywood. And there was Jason Arkwright in drag, those distant eyes, those bones, but with every bit of the Duchess's assurance. The bevy's names were under the photos. There was a Rockefeller and a Whitney. The Duchess, a.k.a. Jason Arkwright, was identified as Bobo Signet. It was obviously the same person as the one in the earlier photo. How had she managed to get away with this transparent alias? Did no one in New York society catch on? I was intensely curious, but knew better than to ask her directly about this. When I came home that night, she began talking about a disease, but very indirectly. It's all creams that kept my skin smooth, all the makeup and hormone injections. Right on my tombstone, she died for beauty. It's so stupid. I don't think that's what causes I trailed off. I tried to learn something about leukemia, but I'd had little experience with disease and dying. AIDS, HIV was a decade and a half and more in the future. It was the beauty treatment, she snarled. I will have it no other way. Straight people die of mundane diseases. I will die of hormones and makeup, or it's not worth dying at all. She insisted we look in the hall closet again. It was mostly empty, but I found a metal bit like a horse's with leather straps and buckles attached and handed it down to her. Grandmother's funeral muzzle, she said. Prevents ones who wake up in the coffin from disrupting the ceremony by yelling that they're still alive. Make sure I'm wearing it when I go. I was still young enough to be able to surprise myself. Standing on the ladder, I started to cry. She was very angry. You don't know me well enough to be grief-stricken at my being gone. In any case, it's none of your business. So I sobbed. I'm just afraid of losing a place to live. This was acceptably distant, as I'd hoped it would be. My dear, she said, I've entangled this place in so many legalities, it will take them years to get rid of you. I'll write you in as a bastard child. And so she did. I started to climb down and saw her shake her head at my stupidity. I turned back and noticed papers on the shelf. The Duchess had disappeared into her bedroom when I descended. Sorting through the pages, I found news and photos of Jason Arkwright's death when his car collided with a tree in 1924. There was also a gossip column from 1935, which hinted at an unsubstantiated rumor that secret men-women had recently infiltrated a certain New York charity event. By the time of that charity event, Jason Arkwright was officially dead and probably half forgotten. And back then, it was inconceivable to most people that as lovely a woman as Bobo could actually be a man. As I suddenly saw it, the Duchess had somehow managed to erase her ghost and then had given a screw you to the elite that would have spurned her, had they known. That night, I dreamed, for what seemed like the thousandth time, that I was locked in the cellar of my parents' house. The ghost me, in my dreams, reminded me of Jason, half-formed, vulnerable. Waking in my bedroom, I couldn't go back to sleep and couldn't stop thinking of Garcia in his last days. We'd been together for 6 months and more when he started to be distant and withdrawn and kept calling in sick for work. One night, he had me back sleeping on the living room couch, and I was afraid he was tired of me. Next morning, he sent me out on a long list of errands, something he'd never done before. When I got back that afternoon, an ambulance and a cop car were outside the building. I ran up the stairs, and the apartment door was open. A cop and the nosy lady from down the hall were in there. My suitcase was by the door, completely packed and with my phony name on a tag. "There's Tony, the young man I told you about," said the lady. The cop's disdain was automatic. Without my asking, he looked at his notebook and said, "Your friend had a heart attack, as far as they know." He saw my shocked expression and asked a few more questions about Garcia and me. At that moment, Garcia's sister and brother-in-law, people that he'd never talked about, showed up and made it clear they found me disgusting and wanted me gone. I was reminded of home. I carted my suitcase for the first time since the night Garcia found me. Stunned and still dry-eyed, I sat near the fountain in Washington Square. That's when I opened the suitcase and found $500 in bills, a big deal in 1962. That money helped me step out of some bad situations over the next couple of years. There was also a photo of Garcia and me at the Night Owl Cafe that I still have. On postcards, he had written, "Put the dough in the bank, kid. I thought I could take away your pain by loving you, but my time is all used up, and I don't want you to have to see me die. It twisted my heart to hear you cry last night and to know I wouldn't see you anymore. The ghost you dream about is you hating yourself. I was dumb, waited too long to cure myself, and got cheated out of a chunk of my life. I should have been more careful, taking you to the doorman, places like hell, but they can get rid of ghosts. They take some of your life as payment, so they can live forever. But you got plenty of life left. Demand to see the boss, maybe the boss's boss, if you need to. Don't settle for less than 50 years, maybe a little extra." The memory of my face in a thousand nightmares had kept me away from the doorman. The Duchess, though, knocked me out of my psychotic sleeping beauty trance. Her last weeks were spent in St. Vincent's Hospital in the village. Mostly she was in a morphine doze, but once, when I was alone with her, she opened her eyes, looked into mine, and said, "I bribed the powers with a couple of decades of my life, and they killed the cowardly boy I had been. Do the same, or spend the rest of your life crying in your sleep." An irritating habit, by the way. The hospital Johnny only partly covered her. Arranging the sheets, I saw her on her hip, what looked like a tattoo. I'd seen one like it on Garcia's hip. He never let me read his. Hers had a date, 3 days away. Her last words on that last day to a room full of friends were, "Dropping dead is like getting to snub everyone you ever knew." Most of the wake and funeral attendants reminded me of the Wax Museum on Sunset Boulevard. An elderly lawyer present to safeguard family interests was the only representative of the Arkwrights. The burial was at a famous old cemetery in Brooklyn, where the family owned a big plot. The Countess saved us from too much sadness by throwing herself into the grave, crying out, "Bobo, I followed you into Dior's found in flea markets and lesbian cabaret stylings, and I will follow you now." She broke her ankle, and an ambulance had to come to the graveside to haul her away. I believe the Duchess would have approved. Butterflies filled the air. Not long after that, I went down the alley far to the east of Bleecker and knocked on the cellar door. I wished Garcia were with me. By then, I had spoken to a few others who had done business with the powers. Some thought the doorman and company worked for God. Some bet on Satan, but none had ever heard of the powers breaking their word. The doorman said to come in, and it felt like he expected me. I'd rehearsed my lines. I told him, "I'll keep 50 years of my life and a bit more. The rest is yours if you get rid of the ghost." He answered, 30 years more is what you get. The rest is ours." But I'd learned a bit about bargaining in the boutiques and said, "I want to talk to your boss." He kept the sneer, but I could tell this made him almost as scared as I was. I had to strip and kneel down inside the black room that lay behind the little office. The air seemed to be rising out of a cold cave. Two things were visible in the dark. The first was a huge face, pale as the moon, and with dark, staring eyes. The second was me, or that version of me I'd left in the old Penn Station. I was walking at dawn down the street my family maybe still lived on. His eyes were cast down, and he had a rope under his arm. I remembered bits of this dream from the last few years, and I knew what was going to happen. Then I needed to be strong. The cold, my nakedness, the unfolding horror as my ghost reached the park and found the right tree was meant to intimidate. I was afraid, but thought of the Duchess's bravery and Garcia's love. "We will end this one who lives inside you," said a distant voice as my ghost tied the rope around a branch. "We will allow you 40 more years of life, and the rest of your years we will keep for ourselves so we can continue our work." 60 or I walk, I said, and kept my eyes on the kid, who was part of me, putting the noose around his neck, standing on a branch, and getting ready to jump. The boss's pale face before me blinked, and I thought I detected fear. Then another voice, even more distant, the boss's boss, said, 50 years. I watched as the kid who was me jumped off the branch. In a year and a day, I said, not knowing where that came from. Then my nerve broke. I looked away before my ghost neck snapped. Done, said the most distant voice. Amusing, it added, and I glimpsed my ghost, a darkening face and bulging eyes, the hands and legs flapping. The doorman came in, looking pale, pulled me to my feet and struck my hip. My tattoo grew there. I looked back after I got dressed. The faces of my ghost and the boss's had all disappeared. The alley is gone now, with the building that housed the doorman's office and the dark room. A boutique tourist hotel sits on the spot. An irony is that 10 years ago, my partner Lewis and I did the lobby decoration. I can only imagine what the Duchess would say. I think of her and Garcia always. My ghost never appeared again, and it's been a long time since I heard anything about the doorman or the bosses. Maybe they acquired enough years from those like me to live forever. But I hope it's because the supply of refugees who need to flee their own self-hatred has dried up. 50 years, and a year and a day, seems such a long time when one is only 20. My life has had its tragedies and joys, but today is my 71st year, plus one day. And on a chilly November, a butterfly flutters past my window.
Met her in a club down in North Soho, where you drink champagne and it tastes just like Coca-Cola. C-O-L-A, Cola. She walked up to me and she asked me to dance. I asked her her name and in a dark brown voice she said hello.
Champagne and dance all night under electric candles.
it really broke all kinds of barriers. And it was getting top 40 play, and I don't think anybody had listened to the lyrics. There are all these subversive songs like Born to Run. People assume, or Born in the USA, rather. Right. People assume, what a gung-ho song. They didn't listen to the lyrics.
Well, I think one of the things about it...
Lean a little more to your mic, or bring the mic to you. That's all right as well.
I think with Lola, the younger audience was much more prepared, even back in 1970, or whenever that was.
Something like that.
For stuff like Transvestite, sure. This is one of the things that changed considerably, and it changed from the young to the old. That there came a time when young people, I mean, certainly there were bullies and there were people who hated gays and all of that, but mostly not. Mostly they accepted this.
Yeah.
And I think that Lola was, I mean, you know, nobody was...
Careful when you hit the mic, by the way.
Nobody was going to, you know, run out and buy a dress because of this, but I think a lot of the audience did know what was happening. And either...
Yeah, but I think that it was thanks to a wink and a nod.
Yes.
As opposed to the
just like
people that were buying the bubblegum...
well, the Kinks were not
commercials on the stations.
The Kinks were not a bubblegum group.
That's true, but that song did make top 40.
It did, but it wasn't.
It was more of an FM.
Right, the Kinks. I mean, you know, Waterloo Sunset, for instance, is not a bubblegum song.
No.
You know, didn't Ray Davis wrote a book of short stories?
I believe he did.
Yeah, called Waterloo Sunset. I've never read it. There were a couple of British rockers who wrote collections of stories. He wasn't
Pete Townsend wrote a novel, at least.
Right, but there was another, and I'm not going to remember
Horse's
who it
Neck,
was.
I think, was the name of the novel.
Yes, some part of a horse, anyway. But
yes. I think it was that he was getting horses. He was, performing or something like that.
But, yeah, Lola was quite a surprise.
So we were talking about that story off the air and how my reaction to it was different than my reaction to many of your stories. That my reaction to many of your stories are that they are either almost mainstream, like the one that's in the Revelator currently. It doesn't have a lot of fantastic element to it. Then there are stories that are outright science fiction / fantasy, true genre. And then there's weird tales. This one was a ghost story.
Right, of which there aren't too many. There's a Hole in the City is always called a ghost story, and I think it is.
It is. It is a ghost story, but it's more of a spiritual ghost story.
Well,
in a way.
The thing with There's a Hole in the City is that, I mean, it's kind of awful. I mean, it's about the Triangle Shirt Factory. It's about various catastrophes. But all of those tragedies are overshadowed by 9/11. In the shadow of 9/11, all of that stuff almost seems quaint. And that, I think, is one of the...
Because it's historic stuff.
Right.
The other ones didn't happen in our lifetime.
We didn't see it.
And there's not much film of it. You know,
there's none.
There
are photographs of the triangle thing. A morgue was set up in Washington Square Park, and you see there are photos, this is really awful, of the parents, in most cases, of the women who died, coming to identify the corpses. And in one of the pictures, there's a New York cop. You know, he's got the tall hat and everything that they wore. And he's actually looking down. He can't stand it.
Yeah. But human could,
Right. There was, I don't know if they're still doing it, but now we're on the Triangle Shirt disaster, if you know. There was a group that was going around the village and chalking in front of the part of the buildings where they had lived, the names of victims. And that was quite startling.
Well, we just had the 100th anniversary.
When I was
not
first,
long ago.
When
so
I was
that,
first
that
working for
why?
NYU, there was nothing. This would be like, 1970. There was really nothing about the Triangle Shirt Disaster. And the main buildings of NYU, it's three buildings. One of them is the building where the disaster took place. And a kid that I knew, a guy that I knew, was a activist. He knew this was there. We went upstairs. It was like the 11th floor in the Brown Building or whatever. And we were up there. It was the biology department was in there at that point. And there were... The fire exits were blocked. There were boxes in front of the fire exits.
Oh, my God.
Although, there are other ways of getting out. Anyway, yes, this apparently is a ghost story.
I was just going to differentiate. The thing about there's a hole in the city, even though there are teams...
You got ghosts.
You know, you and Daniel Jose Older, I'm not sure which one,
I got more ghosts than he got.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. But the difference is that the story of Meg.
Yeah, Meg's.
Yeah. The personal aspect of that story and the way that it's told clearly from the author, shall we call him Rick's point of view, the protagonist's point of view, and the dealing with those people, it's a very, very personal one-on-three story.
Yep.
And therefore, that's why, even though it has this immense background to it, on the personal level, to me, it's almost an affirming kind of feeling at the end to realize
life goes on, basically.
In a way, absolutely. And that's different than this one. This one is more of a classic ghost / dark fantasy / horror story.
Right, this does have those elements. I was going to say Chris Dykeman when I was doing this.
Chris Dykeman is another writer who
is in the Altered Fluid writing group. And when I was putting this through the Altered Fluid.
And it's been too long. She was on the show 15 years ago. She has to come.
Has to return.
Yeah, you told
me. But she told me that the thing that she found fascinating in the story was what happens to rent boys when they're no longer boys? And that is something I do know a thing or two about. And it was the Duchess came first. That character appeared first.
Mm-hmm.
I did a reading. It was a very short thing. It was mainly just the Duchess. And then came the narrator, whose real name you never know. I mean, he's got a phony name, but you don't know the narrator's name.
Yeah, Tony.
Tony. And then I needed something, why is he so disconnected? And at that point, that's when the ghosts came in.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the construction of the thing. Thinking back on it, I suppose it's the most ghostly story I've written. Yes.
And perhaps, would you say the darkest fantasy? You see, it isn't really.
Well, it's not the darkest. There are some extremely dark stories.
There really are, yeah.
I mean, some of the stuff in... some of the stuff in Minions of the Moon, I had a lot of trouble when I was writing Minions of the Moon, writing various things about Grierson, who basically is me, his childhood, especially, the things that are done to him, the things that, he participates in these, but he's just a kid. I had a lot of difficulty writing, like, the YMCA story,
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing in there. There was a story which fantasy and science fiction published 8 of the 10 Grierson stories.
Yeah.
But a couple of them they didn't.
That was under Gordon Van Gelder.
No, that was under Chris Rush. Chris Rush was the one who discovered me as a short story writer.
Okay.
And Gordon published the last of them, and I'm very glad for that. But yeah. She published 7 of the 10, and one of them she could not. And it's called The Judges of the Secret Court, and it's about a kid, and it's one of the chapters in Minions of the Moon. It's when Grierson has stopped drinking, but is like still completely attached to the world that he had lived in when he was an alcoholic and a drug addict. And this is a kid who Grierson has a doppelganger, and the kid thinks that he's in love with Grierson, but he's actually in love with the doppelganger. And Grierson is a great disappointment to the kid. The kid has been is making movies in which he plays Russian roulette on in front of the camera.
Yeah.
And this is a very hard story. It's a very tough story to write. There was stuff in there that was just... But those I think, are closer to horror than this. Mm-hmm. I mean, those are stronger, or it may just be because they're closer to me. Although this is actually kind of... I mean, there's a lot of me in a lot of my stories. And
yeah, but obviously not the ghostly parts, not the dark fantasy parts... are not necessarily things you've experienced. It's more within your imagination.
Some of it is stuff that I experienced, or was dreams, or that kind of thing.
Right. How many stories do you have, unwritten stories, do you have in you at any one time? It's a bizarre question.
Usually it's one at a time that I write. Sometimes they back up. At this point, I have 3 stories under. One of them, it's a story going to be set in New York, but it's about Boston.
Uh-huh.
And it's about basically doing either a play or a movie about a certain criminality.
Boston has become... The new stage. So many of your stories are village-based and New York-based. You grew up, of course, in Boston. And Boston seems to be your current stage.
Well, it was suggested, actually Steve Berman suggested that I do a book.
Steve Berman of Letha Press.
Of Letha Press. That, I think, did change some of my thinking. But
We should tell people looking... this up, Letha is L-E-T-H-E, Letha Press.
Letha Press, yes, and they do some really great stuff. They do my stuff. They did Chris Barzak's Before and Afterlife.
Yeah, this is a gay press that does mostly spec fic?
No, it does all kinds of, it does porn that isn't, that kind of stuff. And it does basically... Chris's collection is more straight than not, actually.
That's actually true, yeah.
Yeah. So it's not strictly that. They brought out the reprint of Minions of the Moon, and they brought out Dust Devil on a Quiet Street. And God knows what else they... but we'll see what else they bring out. He suggested that, and I have shifted over to writing about Boston, and it has been quite interesting. You know, it's like things that I'd forgotten have come back. It was...
So it's interesting. So you're re-delving, I guess.
I'm re-delving. I mean, there were parts of Minions that were set
in
Boston.
New word, I think, re-delving.
Re-delving, yes. There were parts of Minions that were set in Boston, but...
yeah.
So, yes, it has a hold on me still.
Yeah, and it's... But we were talking about how many stories you have.
Oh, at this moment.
How many germinate?
How many are
time?
There at this one time? Well, there is the story that...
This one, but in general for you.
In general,
you are a prolific writer.
Kind of. But... they usually come one at a time. In this case, for a couple of reasons, there are 3 or really perhaps 4. One of them is the Boston gangster or whatever it is story that's going to be. It's about people putting on or creating a play or a movie,
mm-hmm.
basically. So that one is there, and that one is I need to do some work. I also have I promised a story to Alan Dadlow for an anthology called Black Feathers, and it's going to be bird horror.
Oh, my God.
God, yes, and there's nothing more horrible than a bird, apparently. But that one I haven't started at all, although she doesn't know that. But that's not due until the end of the year. I also have this.
I'm sure she never listens to this show except when she's on it. So.
Oh, I'm positive of that, but others may.
and tell her, yes.
Yes. There's another one which is part of the big arena thing, with New York as the Venice of the West. New York was, you know, the ocean coming up onto the land, and then there is a time travel-y story that I will put in as the new story in the reprint of From the Files of the Time Rangers.
Ah, okay.
But I have partially stolen it from a book, a story called My Life in Speculative Fiction, which really is autobiographical.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there's a bit in there. There are bits and pieces of old stories that they wrote in there. And there is something. There is a time travel story, but it needs some work. So we got four stories altogether at this point. I hope to have all of this cleared up at the end of the year.
Yeah.
That is not the way it usually works. Usually it's one at a time. When all of these are finished, and assuming they all get published, I will have published like 80 stories.
Wow.
The first story never sold, although I certainly cannibalized it and used it elsewhere, but it has not sold.
Have you ever taken such stories and, you know, submitted them again, put them through the mill of publishers again?
You mean and they had been sold already? No, you can't.
No. Like you said, your first story has never sold.
That's the only one, and the only one that didn't sell.
So do you ever dust, you know, that's the only one. Okay.
That's the only one.
Yeah, dust it off, send it out again.
I can't. It's too many parts of it have been used in other stories at this point. It's been, you know, cannibalized. But no, I've never, I try never to do that. I've been very fortunate in that. But yeah, it's about 80 stories, and out of this have come like about 10 novels. 10 books. Some of them are just honest collections. Others are fix-ups.
Right.
And there was even a time at the very start of my career where I wrote actual novels.
Yes, but the mosaic novels, the fix-ups.
Yes.
You managed to turn them into these mosaics that, I mean, especially when we talk about Time Rangers. It works. It really works.
Well, thank you. I was
even though they're individual stories, it works as a novel.
Well, it is much easier if you do a fix-up and go into it knowing you're doing this and the stories that you're writing are going to be part of it, rather than saying, oh, my God, I've got something here, and then having to go back and reshape the stories. I reread From the Files of the Time Rangers, and I wondered if it wasn't too confusing. I mean, it didn't confuse me, but then I've written it, so. You get to use stories twice. You know, you write them, you sell them to a magazine or whatever, and then a couple of years later, chapters in a book.
Yeah. But, like There's a Hole in the City opens Dust Devil.
Now, you know, that was a last-minute decision. Because I had used... in that year of so many books, 2013, I used There's a Hole in the City as the opening chapter in Dust Devil and as a story. I think it's the opening story in my collection, If Angels Fight. but I used it twice.
Yeah.
There.
Not to mention as a standalone story for sci fiction.
It was a standalone story for sci fiction, and
which is a website that no longer exists.
It no longer exists, and it was terrific. That was
yeah,
the 20.
We talked about it at length.
20 week. Cents a word, my God. Well, and back, and that was, you know, back in,
fiction,
and back in 2000.
Good, yeah.
Yeah, it's excellent. But I.
by the way, we're running out of time.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, don't be sorry. I'm sorry that we're running out of time. But what we should do is our wrap-ups. Tell people that they can find you online at rickbowes.com, R-I-C-K-B-O-W-E-S.
.com, and also much more on Facebook. If you're on Facebook, I am there, and it's Richard Bowes. Or on Twitter, which drives me mad.
At Rick Bowes.
Right, it's... and I would be happy to have your thoughts. I would be happy to have thoughts of my own, but since I don't, I'd be happy to have yours.
Okay, and yeah, that's something people can do on, but even then, no, because you have to, there's the whole friending thing.
You have to friend the people, but I, unless you seem like a positive maniac, I will, and even some who do seem
and
like positive.
Then, yes, exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. And I'd like to once again remind people, October 6th, just be here at, you know, we start at 7 o'clock, 388 Atlantic Avenue for the New York Review of Science Fiction readings. And
it's a very nice space.
It really is a nice space.
Yes.
I would never have thought that I would move that reading series to Brooklyn. But
well, this
here
is,
we are. It's really...
Well, this is a huge change. I mean, when I was first doing this 30 years ago, writing 30 years ago, nothing happened in Brooklyn. Now I'm in Brooklyn like once a week at least.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's...
Crossing the waters, that's a big deal.
That's
for
right. That's, getting out of bed is a big deal for me. It's...
So thank you so much.
Thank you.
I think you may not be here in person, but I think that we will... have you on the air somewhere again in the next month during our fundraising drive. We'll make a hole in the city. We have that premium.
That's a great CD. It has, there's a hole in the city in it. It has you talking about there's a hole in the city. And then it has the psychiatrist and myself.
Charles Strozer. Which
Charles
Strozer. Fascinating.
Yes.
Fascinating interview.
Yes.
So thank you all for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. I'll be back next week from 1:30 till 3. And after that, well, it's fundraising. I'll be on like alternate weeks. So it's very strange how it's going to work. So again, thank you, Rick Bowes, Richard Bowes, for being here.
Thank you.
And stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers coming your way with Lister. In just moments. Have a good morning, and everybody be good to each other. Ooh, and don't forget, by the way, there's a blood red moon coming up this weekend. Read your astronomical, not logical, but nomical columns about it. Good morning.
Just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. it. So why the wanna scold me? When I torch the flag, I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. I can flag America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn it.
intelligence, unnecessary violence, apartheid in South Africa, and they're detaining all our leaders. Now people calling now for justice, and people crying now for freedom, and world they want to stop that in this time. Oh yes, don't want no more war crime. Yes Lord, I don't want to see no nuclear soldier. I don't want to see no nuclear soldier. I don't want to see no nuclear in this time. Oh no, no, don't want no more war crime. Computerized technology, a random access memory, lack of human efficiency, causing machines to gain supremacy. Some people calling now for justice, some people crying now for freedom. God, some would love to see the sun stop shining in the sky. Oh yes, don't want no more war crime. Yes Lord, necessary violence.